This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us at TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Going to start off today's show with a bang. We're pleased to be joined now by the general manager of the Calgary Flames, Jay Feaster. Jay, good afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, guys.
Jay, we got to start with the Flames' start to the season. You know, you look around the NHL, and there's a lot of people sort of expressing surprise at how impressive the Flames have been to the start of the season, very competitive in pretty much every game for the most part. How impactful has head coach Bob Hartley been on the youthful roster that the Flames are sporting this year?
Well, he's been a huge factor, there's no question. And I think you have to go back even to last year and the truncated season that we had, and when we made the decision that we were going to go with a rebuild, he was pretty clear in his communication with the players at the end of the season in our exit meetings, and he stayed clear in his communication with them over the summer that it was going to be a difficult training camp. It was one that they had better be prepared for and come in good shape, and to the players' credit, they did that, and I think the players recognized from day one of camp the message that we've been preaching, and that is that we don't have the superstar players. We're not the most talented group in the league. That the whole has to be greater than the sum of its parts, and that the only way we're going to have success is if we bring that mentality and a solid work ethic to every game. And for the most part, we've done that. I think if you look at our last three games, four games, we've kind of gotten away from it a little bit. We've been very, very poor in our starts. We've fallen behind. And certainly, I think the low point of our season was the game here on Thursday night against Dallas. We're really blown out by a Dallas team that has had our number this year. So that's what we're trying to get back to now. And it's what Bob is trying to reinstill in the guys, is to get back to our lunch pail mentality.
You know, Jay, you just acquired Ladislav Smead from Edmonton, and you know, I think you'd mentioned that the talks have been going on for some time. How did those talks come about? Is that something where you reached out to the Oilers and saw a possibility there? Is that something that the Oilers kind of put a player like that out in the market and you approach them?
Well, the way it typically works is that at some point in time as a manager, you'll pick up the phone, and sometimes you'll do it with all 29 teams, that you'll literally make it a point that over the next day or so, I'm going to try to talk to all 29 of my counterparts. But at other times, it's more selective. It may be a team that's not going well, or a team that you get some sense is trying to do something. In this instance, McTee had phoned me, and it was just that kind of a casual conversation. What are you looking to do? And you tell them, well, we're trying to improve our blue line. How about you? Well, you know, we're trying to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we had a number of conversations, and Craig asked if he said, would a guy like Smead be of interest to you? And I think we were clear as we started down the path that what was important to Edmonton was to free up some cap space. Right. And certainly they had identified Ladislav as a guy that they were willing to part with to do that. And it just so happened that he was a player that we had as an acquire in trade from our pro scouts. Our guys have seen him a lot. They feel that they know the kind of player he is, and we've always appreciated his character and the way he plays the game. So that's really the genesis of how that got started, and then you try to see if you can find a match in terms of what the other team is looking for and what you're willing to give up.
Jay, the most recent trade that you made with the Edmonton Oilers, and it was much talked about at the time the trade was made, it was only the second trade ever between the Calgary Flames and the Edmonton Oilers. And you hear about some teams not liking to trade within their own division. What's your perspective on making trades within your own division?
I think, honestly, that you have to be in a situation where if you're getting the player that you want, and if, therefore, it's good for you, and you're prepared to part with the player that the other team wants, you have to be prepared to give up something to get something. And I don't think that you can afford it. It's hard enough in this day and age to make trades in the National Hockey League. I'm not sure that you can just exclude a division or you exclude an opponent because you know you're going to see them quite a bit. And I would say that that's how Edmonton approached it as well. And I would certainly think that McTee would echo that, that it's difficult to do deals. And so it doesn't make sense just to exclude a subset of trading partners.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. The Calgary Flames make their first visit to Winnipeg since the Jets moved back to Winnipeg on Monday night. We're joined by Flames General Manager Jay Feaster right now. Jay, prior to coming to Calgary, your previous management experience was in Tampa Bay, or your most recent management experience was in Tampa Bay, rather. How different is it being an executive in a Canadian hotbed like Calgary than in the untraditional hockey market like Tampa Bay?
Oh, as you can imagine, it's night and day. Certainly when I went to Tampa as an assistant GM back in 1998, it was a constant matter of trying to make hockey relevant in that market. And I think that over the years, I mean, we won the Southeast Division a couple of times, and then we win the Cup in 04. I think that we went a long way to making it relevant in the market, but it's totally different here. It is an ingrained way of life. I say that it's bigger than religion. You're in a situation where it's 24/7. There are radio stations that are devoted entirely to talking about Flames hockey, and the attention that it draws, the attention that you get from the fans, people that you go to the grocery store, you go to church, people want to talk about the team. So It really is a totally different experience. And what's great about it is that even when you're not having success, it's still great to know that the people have that passion. I would much rather having to be talking about why this isn't working or why the power play is not going or why we drafted this particular player over that one. I'd rather be answering those kind of questions than trying to get fans to be passionate about what you're doing.
You know, Jay, when you look around the National Hockey League, and you were a general manager in the AHL, a very successful general manager in the AHL for many years. I'm wondering, in your perspective, it seems like the development curve for some of these junior age players, and they get drafted, and they're maybe too good for the Canadian Hockey League after their draft year, but maybe not good enough to play in the NHL, but aren't able to play in the AHL because of the age requirements. Do you see that changing at all? What's your perspective on that rule?
I think you're exactly right in your premise and in the thesis that you put forth. I honestly don't see that changing. I think that the relationship between the CHL and the National Hockey League, it's the historical relationship. I think it's so ingrained, and I don't. It's interesting that you say it, because it's occasionally you'll have a GM talk about it at a GM's meeting, and it's something that typically just does not get any traction. I don't think we're going to see the system change anytime soon.
Jay, during the offseason, Brian Burke was brought into the Flames organization. In the short time that Brian Burke has been with the Calgary Flames, what kind of impact has he had on the organization?
The biggest impact, I think, is just being a resource for us, being a sounding board, being someone who we can throw ideas off of when we're considering something, or he will come to us and say, we just got this email that player X is available. What do you guys think of him? And can he help us? If so, who are we taking out of the lineup? Who do we have to send down? How do we make a roster spot? Again, just challenging us and being there as a sounding board. In the case of Smead, for example, we felt we knew the player. We see Edmonton a lot. We scout Edmonton a lot. We watch them. So we felt that we knew what we were getting as far as on the ice, but we're able to go to a guy like Brian, who, of course, he had him. He had him when he was in Anaheim and traded him in the Pronger deal. And so you're able to go to Brian and talk about, tell us about this guy as a person. How was he in the room for you when you had him? What's his reputation? So those are the kind of things that are very, very helpful.
Now, Jay, looking at your team is obviously rebuilding right now, but you have a pretty strong core on the back end. Obviously, there's some injuries there, but when healthy, you know, Giordano, Weidman, and TJ Brody, and you've brought in Ladislav Smead. How important is it for a rebuilding team to have a strong defense to be able to kind of develop those younger forwards?
It's huge, and that's why also you take one step back from the blue line, and that is that the one area that we have to shore up, and we need to get some answers that send us in the right direction. We need to shore up the goaltending too. Mm-hmm. I agree with you about the defense, and really the guys you mentioned, probably the best defenseman for us through the first 19, 20 games this year, is a guy you didn't mention, and that's Chris Russell.
Yeah.
Russ has just been phenomenal for us. And as you know, I mean, we were looking with the Smead deal, we were looking to improve our blue line before the injury to Mark Giordano. Once Giordano went down, that just put a spotlight on our need to improve the blue line. And you saw it with our 5-6 guys, Derek Smith and Shane O'Brien, averaging less than or right around 10 minutes a game. And you look at a guy like Dennis Wideman, averaging the second most minutes in the National Hockey League for a defenseman, behind only Ryan Suter. So everybody, I think everybody's playing more minutes than we're comfortable with, and really that they're comfortable with, and where they're most effective. So that's why this Smead deal, he played almost 21 minutes the other night. I think you're going to start to see that balance out. And when we get Giordano back, I think you'll see the minutes smooth out even more.
Right.
So it is important to have that good group of defensemen. And as I said, now the other thing we need to do is we need some answers between the pipes.
Jay, we'll let you go on this last question. As you're no doubt aware, there's the advanced, you know, metrics, the advanced analytics movement in hockey. There was the big conference in Toronto last weekend that coincides with the Hockey Hall of Fame weekend. How much weight do you personally put on advanced analytics in player evaluation, and how much weight does the Flames as an organization put on it?
When I took over as GM, one of the first hires I made was bringing Chris Snow in as our director of video and statistical analysis. Chris had been with the Minnesota Wild organization. We rely very heavily on the PUCKS, P-U-C-K-S, the PUCKS system. It's both a video and a statistical database-driven system, and we use that a lot. It really allows us to look at all sorts of information on players and matchups, and from a statistical perspective, what are league averages? How does this player compare to the league average for what shots are goals? Whatever the case may be, we're very much aware of Corsi and Fenwick, but our primary focus is on the utilization of pucks, and we do utilize that before we make deals. If we're talking about a guy like Smead, we're going to run those what we consider to be advanced analytics on the player before we do the deal.
Jay Feaster is the general manager of the Calgary Flames. They'll play the Oilers tonight. Jay, best of luck in your game tonight, and we look forward to seeing you on Monday here in Winnipeg when the Flames make their first visit.
Thanks. We're looking forward to it as well. Look forward to being there.
Take care, Jay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we get into the Jets-Flyers game from last night. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to Calgary Flames General Manager Jay Feaster for having just joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, we will have it available for you on IllegalCurve.com and on TSN1290.ca. Still to come on today's show, we sat down earlier today with Al Strachan, a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist. He's got a brand new book out. It is called 99... Gretzky, his game, his story. So that's going to come up in about 45 minutes time. We'll have that interview for you. And then later on in the program, Mike Greenlay, he's the Minnesota Wild TV analyst. So he's going to join us to talk about the Wild Jets game tomorrow evening in St. Paul, and a game you can, of course, hear live on TSN 1290.
I could do a 3-hour show on Gretz with Strachan if he has the time.
That's right up. That's a fastball down the heart of the plate for you.
Uh-huh.
I know. When you heard what that, you know, when I told you that he's coming on and the uh-huh. book and everything else, you got excited. Anyways, let's get back to last night, or start analyzing last night's game against the Flyers. The Jets, of course, 3-2 victors over the Flyers in a shootout. They got off the power play. Schneid, Dustin Byfuglien getting two power play goals in the course of the game. But first, before we get into last night's game, the team has updated the condition of defenseman Zach Bogosian. They say he is he's not going to make the road trip. He's not going to play in Minnesota, and it sounds like he is longer than day to day. They have not completely said what the injury is. It's supposedly lower body. It is more serious than a day to day injury, but as for the actual specifics, yet to be determined. I was in my seats last night I couldn't tell. I just noticed he wasn't on the ice. I couldn't tell the injury. I don't know if you guys had a better vantage point.
Well, we not only do we not know how serious the injury, I don't even know what play the injury happened on, because it was Rick Ralph, of course, of the station of the Round Table, who came up to us first and noticed, Richie, that Bogo wasn't on the bench there in the third period. I have absolutely no idea what play the injury occurred on. And, you know, it's difficult to really make any comments on it, quite frankly. You know, I mean, lower body, as we know, when you hear lower body, sometimes you can kind of make a guess, Richie. But,
well, as Drew said, if your arm's down, that's a hand injury. And if your arm's up, it's an upper body.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Upper body.
Yeah. But as far, you know, maybe we can get some, you know, information throughout the show about the injury. But, you know, Bogosian replaced by Keaton Ellerbe there with Tobias Enstrom. Well, I thought he did a very good job. And, you know, looking forward, you have to think that Zach Redman plays his first game of the year tomorrow.
That's right. Zach Redman's going to check into the lineup. The team called up Julian Melchiori, so he's now going to be the seventh defenseman in the press box, although it does sound like Mark Stewart is getting close to returning to action as well. We'll get more into the Jets' defense, you know, sort of how it's going to line up later on in the show.
The Mark Stewart injury hasn't cost him, because Pardy and Ellerbe have both played very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, you know, obviously a Bogosian injury is huge, especially for a team tomorrow in Minnesota. I mean, short term is obviously more than a short term injury, but Zach Bogosian's a skater, logs big minutes, solid in his own zone. Minnesota, really fast team, pressures the puck, all that stuff. So you replace Zach Bogosian with anybody in the Jets system, downgrade.
Mm-hmm.
Immediate downgrade. Unless it's Jacob Trouba, it's a downgrade. And it's not going to be Trouba. So it's not a good matchup. Now, Calgary on Monday, and then after that, the Jets' schedule from here on outside from Minnesota and Chicago for the rest of the month isn't that hard.
They go out east to play the Eastern Conference sisters.
Yeah, but, you know, these next two of the next three games are difficult, and they're certainly going to miss Bogosian against teams that can fly in Chicago and Minnesota.
Especially three out of the four next games being in division. Minnesota twice tomorrow and the next Saturday, Chicago on Thursday, and Calgary, which would be the quote-unquote easiest of the games, but we know the Flames do play they're a hard-working team, mm-hmm. short on talent, but for the most part, they've been a hard-working team so far this year. Let's talk about last night's game. Jets came out like gangbusters in the first 10 minutes.
They did.
Then Philly was able to tie the game, you know, on that wraparound goal. A goal, which really probably only happens this year because of the new shallower nets.
I think it's a shallower nets, and I think it's people talking about the shallower nets makes players more apt to try it even.
Sure.
You know? But yeah, I think it is the shallower nets is a big factor.
And then they get the power play goal from Wayne Simmons. That must have been Simmons' first goal in a while. Because
it was the second goal of the year.
Second goal of the year. Yeah. Which just really does exemplify how much struggles Philly has had for most of the season.
Yeah. Their style of play, when you see them in person, their style of play is not the Flyers team of 2 years ago. I mean, it's totally changed. So mm-hmm. They're not going to be scoring five a game.
Right. Yeah. And then it was that last 10 minutes of the third period, mm-hmm. the Flyers looked like a team that was at the end of a three-game and four-night situation. They couldn't even control the puck.
Well, you mentioned that the Jets came out like gangbusters. And then I guess what I would say to that is, for most of the second period and the early part of the third period, they came out like jambusters. Because that...
I was waiting for the jambuster joke.
In that second,
it's also known as a jelly donut.
Right.
Yeah.
For those who aren't familiar with the jambuster, I guess. The Philadelphia Flyers have really, you know, altered their style under Craig Berube. Mm-hmm. They were playing more of a up-tempo, a little bit more complicated system under Peter Laviolette, and obviously struggling, losing those three games, and cost Laviolette his job that start. But in that second period, you know, we were sitting beside Anthony Sanfilippo, who we had on Wednesday and we've had on the show many times, and it looked like the New Jersey Devils of the early 2000s, how they were just completely shutting the game down, perfectly happy to win a game 2-1, and they completely bored the Jets to death,
mm-hmm.
And the Jets weren't generating much offense. You know, the shot count was high enough, and they outshot the Flyers quite badly in the third period. But, you know, again, Philadelphia was taking some pretty dumb penalties yesterday.
Well, I mean...
And this is a situation, guys, you know, the Jets are on the four-game winning streak, and they've won the three games in a row in the shootout. But really, finally, you can say that the special teams came through for them. And Byfuglien came through big time, because going into the game, you know, you have six goals on the power play in 20 games. You've got the worst power play in the league by far. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it so much on the show, and Claude Noel's been asked about it probably 200 times already this year. But really, it comes through for them. And, you know, you look at the game and you say, okay, it wasn't the most exciting game, Richie.
No.
But they end up getting the 2 points. Yep. You score 25% of your power play goals in that one game.
In
the season. And that's all that really matters. Because we've talked about it. The Jets will have to put these win streaks together to make the playoffs this year. You know, we were looking at the standings. The Jets have won 4 games in a row, still 6 points out of the playoff spot. So, I mean, you gotta now do that.
Yeah.
You know, another
and with St.
times.
Louis is 4 games in hand.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's great for the Jets. Like, kudos to the Jets for getting that win yesterday, finding a way to win, coming back from, you know, a 1-goal deficit against a team that was, you know, coming into the building winners of their last three. What? You find a way to win. You get the power play going. You know, it's something to build off of.
The Jets just don't hurt. Right now, they're playing well because they're playing a simple game. They're not hurting themselves too much. They're not taking tons of stupid penalties. They're not turning the puck over. They're playing a simple game, and they're letting other teams beat themselves. And probably the way they have to play to win a lot of games. It's not the most exciting style, but you know, it's getting them some victories right now. Now, it's not getting them regulation victories or overtime victories. And so, I mean, there's two perspectives on it, right? There's a perspective of, oh, you know, they're playing really well. To me, shootouts are crapshoots. So, I mean, they lose all three of these games, they feel like the worst team in the league. They win three, they feel like gangbusters. But you take a step back and you say, okay, this team has only three teams have less regulation wins than the Jets. That's Florida, Buffalo, and Edmonton. So, I mean, that's a worrisome note that you're not beating teams. When, you know, to me, when it's determining who's actually the better team. Having said that, obviously, as you said, you take your points, you get the power play going last night, you take advantage of a bad change by Philly on the first goal. Mm-hmm. The second goal, you put the puck on the net, and Mason just misses it.
Yeah, and that was a Steve Mason Columbus Blue Jackets goaltender goal.
And there's other, and you know what? He was great last night, though. The Jets really peppered him in the third, and he was terrific. So if you're the Jets, you're feeling good about yourself for sure. But as you guys mentioned, still far out of the playoffs, and still have to keep going here. And the schedule you mentioned, Drew, 3 of the next 4, Chicago, Minnesota, but after that, not that tough.
And your point about the regulation wins is well taken, but I think the Jets, I don't think can focus on that. If it ends up biting,
well, the Jets aren't, because they're going to focus on obviously wanting to stay positive. I'm taking a step back and thinking, okay, you still can't beat anybody in regulation and a regular clean win.
Sure.
I'm not even talking overtime. I'm talking 5-on-5. Like, that's when the playoffs are played.
Well, I mean, the Jets were fortunate just to get that game into the shootout yesterday. I don't know what the last 10 minutes of regulation.
Yeah.
Philly couldn't touch the puck, and they had to ice it consistently. They looked like they were completely gassed. Jets tied it up.
Yeah.
And then in overtime, Andre Pavlik was unbelievable.
It was great.
Like,
yeah,
the Jets looked
Coburn
like,
a couple times. Oh, one thing on why isn't Noel using the timeout there?
I was wondering the same thing.
Two icings. He doesn't use a timeout.
I said to Laura, my wife. In the seats, I said, timeout Winnipeg. And then when they didn't call the timeout, I'm thinking, did he call it earlier in the game? And I didn't mind
the first time he didn't call it because they had LeCavalier on against the Jets, and LeCavalier can't win a draw. But when they switched Giroux on after the icing, and Giroux was coming up, his line was coming up, and he was on his right side taking the draw, and the Jets didn't call a timeout. And they lost the draw, by the way.
Well, they lost every draw in overtime. They could barely control the puck.
I thought that was an odd play by Noel, who I think is coached very well. I thought it was misuse. If you have a timeout, why are you leaving it on the table?
Right.
Yeah, you leave it on the table for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
You can't use a timeout in the shootout.
That's right.
So the point is well taken there. And, you know, as far
point
as...
Point for the shootout or my point?
Your point. and they'll also take the extra point in the shootout. But, you know, as far as the management of that game goes, you look at the game and it was looking like... Earlier on in the season, guys, earlier in that game when the Jets were generating a lot of their scoring chances from the perimeter, pretty boring game. The crowd was out of it. And then
well,
you
that
get
second
the
period put everybody to sleep.
Yeah, you get the crowd back in it.
Worst period ever.
Get the crowd back in it, and you look at the game, and the positives are, okay, you won again in the shootout. Pavlik's played well after being kind of shaky earlier last week. And, you know, you've managed to get points now in 4 straight games. Not just points. You've got max points. And you needed that. So you're 1 game above 500 as far as wins goes. I know it's not really 500,
as long as you said it's not really 500,
right? But I mean, the point being that they're above.
That they're drives me crazy.
Above a line, if you want to look at it like that. And
just so the listeners understand what you're saying, Drew, is if you're the NHL makes it everything. You know, they put lipstick on a pig. But what you mean, Drew, is if you lose in regulation, you get a loss. But it's not the same for losing.
Or just look at
but if you win in regulation, you get a win. But if you win in overtime, You still get a win, and if you lose in overtime, you don't get a loss.
That's right. 10 of 21 games. That's
right.
Not 500.
500 to me is if they beat Minnesota, they will have won 11 of the 22 games they've played. Their winning percentage at that point in time will be 500.
Right.
Their points percentage right now is over 500, but their winning percentage is less than 500.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, one thing I want to get back to is, you know, the Flyers changing their style. It's all fine and dandy, but, you know, we were saying... last night, you can't take stupid penalties. So Steve Downey takes like four penalties in a row.
Yeah,
they only call the last one. And I don't know if you heard Craig Berube in the locker room after, said they asked him about Steve Downey's penalty. He said, why don't you go ask him?
And Downey, to his credit, I mean...
Well, everybody in the locker room basically said, go ask him.
Sure.
So he had to go stand up to that.
Well, of course, because literally, it was three penalties. It was the third penalty that he didn't call.
You also acquire Steve Downey. What do you expect?
A guy taking penalties, for the most part, I would suspect. I mean, but the Jets managed to pull it out. I mean, it wasn't the prettiest win, but a win's a win for this team. They're not looking for style points.
No, a win's a win, and you have to feel confident. If you're the Jets, you're feeling confident about it. You know,
yeah.
If I'm shoveled off a little more reservations, but if you're in the room and you're Noel, you're building on this and you're feeling confident because you know one thing to certainly take solace in is nobody put out any kind of a Buffalo was good last night, Pav was good, but nobody put out a dominating performance.
And you still won.
And you still won.
I thought Wheeler was good last night.
Yeah, he's fine.
Yeah.
Wheeler hasn't. Little's been the best player on that line by far. Him and Ladd have been great. Mm-hmm. Wheeler hasn't really showed up this year.
Right.
Yeah. Making big money, so he might want to show up. Last night was, I guess, a good start, but he needs to be better.
I thought he had more confidence than I'd seen in a lot of other games in that he was carrying the puck and driving hard at the net.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that to me is sort of one of the benchmarks I use in evaluating how Blake Wheeler's playing in a certain game. If he's using the speed and he's taking a guy from the outside and he's cutting hard, I mean, because his body coming at a goalie, 6'4", 6'5", whatever it is, coming hard at the goalie is an intimidating force. And if he's not doing that, to me, that means he's not as engaged as he should be. Last night, I thought he was driving hard. Obviously, the results weren't quite there, but...
But Tobias Enstrom played a confident game last night.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's sometimes... When you lose a defenseman, when you go down to 5D, it almost makes everybody focus that much harder.
Yeah, you got
to
play harder. But, I mean, they're going to have a tough time replacing Bogosian here.
Sure. You lose Bogosian, then that's just not something that they can replace.
What are you going to do matchup-wise now?
Well, tell you what. Let's go to break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the Jets' defense. Let's do that. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, tickets are all sold out, so if you don't have them, you're out of luck, unfortunately. Tom Segura at Rumors tonight, two shows, already sold out. Just announced for the new year, though. Guys, this will be of interest to you. Chris Kattan, March 6th to 8th.
Ooh.
From from Saturday Night Live on a Saturday Night Live alumnus. Chris Kattan is going to be at Rumors. Night at the Roxbury, sure. March 6th to 8th, Chris Kattan is going to be at Rumors Comedy Club. Tickets go on sale Monday, November 25th at 1 p.m. Remus is very excited.
I was just going to say,
we'll go to
such
that.
A Remus. Nobody loves that.
He just emailed us, or he just messaged us and said he's very excited. Corky Romano, another one of...
That's the Night at the Roxbury, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And
we'll go see that.
Yeah, and was Mr. Peebles, is that what it was?
Remus would know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Mr. Peepers.
I was
Mr.
more
Peepers,
an early sorry. 90s SNL guy.
Okay, anyways, Chris Kattan coming to Rumors. Tickets go on sale Monday, November 25th at 1 p.m.
That movie's hilarious.
Night at the Roxbury?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Jets' defense. You know, when I made up the show plan yesterday, I'd made a note there saying, the Jets' defense is getting healthy. You know, what happens to the defense when Mark Stewart and Jacob Trouba are ready to return? Now, obviously,
which is still a valid question.
Sure, and we'll still discuss it. Obviously, Zach Bogosian's injury, changes that situation. Mm-hmm. But let's sort of look at it in two ways. Zach Bogosian injury, You know, Mark Stewart practiced today with the Jets, a full practice. Jacob Trouba was on the ice in non-contact colors. So, again, he's probably still probably a week or, you know, 2 weeks away, I would suggest. He'll need to get some contact in before he's ready to go.
You think?
Yeah, I do think. Contact with something other than the boards, I hope, as
exactly.
well. So, you know, how do you see the Jets' defense lining up? Let's say if Zach Bogosian is out of the lineup for a little while and Mark Stewart is ready to get back in.
Well, I guess there's two parts to that, Richie. Mark Stewart coming back, then he's a third pairing defenseman for this team, so you're looking at him most likely replacing Adam Partey. But let's go with Bogosian here, because right before the break, Richie mentioned some of the issues that his absence will have on the matchups, and you had Keaton Ellerbe playing up there with Tobias Enstrom, and if that's any indication, you have a guy who's a left shooting defenseman, mm-hmm. a big guy, more of a stay at home guy, and I wouldn't be surprised if he gets matched up with Enstrom. Now, when you put Zach Redmond into the lineup, he hasn't played in a while. He played a couple games with the Ice Caps in the AHL. But you'd have to think that, he would maybe go with Adam Partey on that final pair, that third pairing for the Jets. And, Keaton Ellerbe, forget the fact that they're 5-1 since they acquired Keaton Ellerbe. He played 21 minutes last night. Not a lot of flash to his game. He's a big guy, physical guy, more physical than Adam Partey has been, certainly, and he's not going to get a lot of points in his NHL career. In the 4 or 5 years he's played in the NHL, he's obviously been claimed off waivers by the Jets now, and before that he was acquired by the Kings from the Panthers, but he's a guy that I think has been very solid. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're asking him to go out there and play with Adam Partey on the third pair, and he's been pretty good. And my guess would be that they keep Ellerbe with Enstrom, because you're not going to put Redmond into the lineup and have two guys that are more kind of mobile guys, not very physical guys. But, I mean, there are matchup issues there. You're going against a Minnesota Wild team. Right now, Zach Parise looks, Richie, like the 94-point yep. Zach Parise from mm-hmm. 6 years ago. So, I mean, it's a concern, and we're not sure if Bogo's going to be out one or two games or if he's going to be out six. But then you start bringing in, Mark Stewart, and are you going to put him back on the third pair with and taking out Adam Partey? But absolutely, I mean, Keaton Ellerbe, if he's going to play a little bit more time, ideally I think you'd want that time to be split out. I don't think a guy like Keaton Ellerbe you want playing 27 minutes a game, but my guess would be that Ellerbe stays with Enstrom. Claude Noel really likes Klitsam and Bufflin together, and then I think you'd put Redmond with Partey. That's the way I see the D pairings unfolding.
Well, yeah, I don't know, Ez. I mean, a couple of things. First off, I think Redmond needs to get some time here. You've lost two right-sided guys in Trouba and Bogosian. Give him a shot. I mean, he can skate. He can play the game. I think he needs to get in there. I'd put him with Enstrom if you want to keep Bufflin and Klitsam together. I mean, with all due respect to Mark Stewart, who's a heart and soul guy, I mean, the guys who've been playing, they've been playing better than he played. I wouldn't put Mark Stewart in the lineup.
But Richie, are
and
you?
I don't mean I respect Mark Stewart. And he wears an A. He kills penalties. He does all that stuff. But, I mean, the way Partey and Ellerbe have been playing, Stewart can wait a game or two before he gets in there.
Richie, are you not concerned, though? Redmond hasn't played in 2 weeks, and is he going to play 25 minutes a night on the top pair?
I don't even mind it. I mean, you limit his power play and penalty kill time then, and you're only playing him, 18, 19. I that's a fair point, Ezzy, but I guess just, you got to play at some point, and they might want to ease him into the lineup, but you're telling me that the concern there is Ellerbe, Partey, or Stewart's playing top 4 minutes. I actually think, I just don't know if those guys can. I want to see a little more of Redmond, of course. We haven't seen that much of him, and I think, sometimes we glorify the guy we haven't seen a lot.
Yep.
But
I think he's wasting away in the press box. If you're not going to play him, I'd rather see him just getting more time in the AHL to make sure get his legs under him a little bit more.
I know. He wants a shot, so, let him have at it, but the Mark Stewart, I think the name carries more value than the play on the ice, in all honesty. And again, I do respect what he brings to the table, but he's a 6'7 guy now. He's not a great skater, doesn't do much offensively. He'll block shots and all that stuff, but the guys who replaced him have done a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, and before Adam Partey was put on waivers by the Jets after signing that deal, and he's played well. So Adam Partey has made himself valuable now. So, all things being equal, when Jacob Trouba is back and Zach Bogosian is back, you have a situation where now Keaton Ellerbe, Adam Partey, and Mark Stewart are now competing for that sixth spot.
Which is how it should be. because they're all third pairing defensemen.
Right. And that is a good problem to have. And you know, you'd have to think that when Mark Stewart is healthy, he's been out for about 2 weeks now, that because of the fact that he has the A and he's been on the Jets and the Thrashers for a while now, he will go back into the lineup and Party will come out, but now it's not as automatic. Before, when Adam Party was forced into action, you know, people were a little bit hesitant. And, you know, Adam Party, similar to a guy like Keaton Ellerbe, is a guy that just plays a simple game defensive. He's a big guy, and he's improved. I know in the preseason he struggled a little bit for the Jets, but Party's another one of those guys that has gone from team to team. And when you're kind of bouncing around from team to team, you become a journeyman defenseman. You know, you gotta find your groove a little bit. And you know, as far as Mark Stewart goes, it is possible that, you know, he doesn't come back or he ends up coming out of the lineup throughout the year when healthy with a guy like Adam Party or a Keaton Ellerbe. Mm-hmm. But right now, you know, I don't have too many negative things to say about the defense. Sure, you know, they have their moments where they get hemmed in their own zone and they look a little bit disorganized. But for the most part, you know, this group of defensemen, Bogo included, they've been doing a pretty good job. Like you're talking about, they've beaten the Wings, they've beaten the Sharks. Like, you know, they've been decent, and they've been keeping the games relatively low scoring.
And they're scoring now. I mean, Bogosian scores a goal in Detroit. Buffen pops two last night.
Mm-hmm. Getting some offense from the back end.
Which they were due.
Sure, that's really, I mean, if you look at the defense, you'd say the strength of this defense is almost their offensive upside rather than their solid defensive play in their own zone. Let me ask you guys this question. Let's say everybody was healthy. Maybe leave Paul Postma out because we know he's out. He's going to be out for a number of months with the blood clotting situation. And let's say Bogosian's injury is relatively minor and it's, you know, he's back next week. Mm-hmm. And Trouba's almost back and Stewart's almost back. And you have Party and you have Ellerbe and you have Redmond. Who's your top six now on this team?
Top six is Bufflin.
Obviously, we know the top four.
Bogosian, Enstrom, Trouba, Klitsam, and then... Probably Ellerbe right now. It's played solid since he got here. Those are your six.
So Ellerbe over Party and over mm-hmm. Redmond mm-hmm. and over Stewart.
And you're also guys going to see one of these guys get sent down.
Yeah.
Because you can't have three defensemen on your active roster.
Well, that's
there.
The thing, right? So because, you have Redmond as your two-way.
Right. Because you've already called up Melchiori so that when Stewart comes back, Melchiori goes back down.
Well, I wasn't even including Melchiori, but right.
But I'm just saying, as far as they're going to have some roster moves to make because... Essentially, what's happened is now you have a guy that was acquired in Party, who you put on waivers, but now he's actually become useful for you, as has Ellerbe. So now you have a situation where you actually have two guys that are useful that weren't before.
Yeah.
That's a good situation to have, but I would assume one of those guys gets sent down. It might be Party.
Yeah, but don't confuse quantity with quality. We get into this every year. Mark Flood, seventh defenseman here, plays a couple of good games against third and fourth lines. You know, I mean, Ellerbe went on waivers and wasn't claimed by the teams below the Jets. You know, we knew the Flames needed defense, stuff like that. So, I mean, it's not like he's played solid here, but it's a couple games. You know, Adam Party went on waivers, nobody claimed him.
In protected situations,
that's fine, but I mean, they're playing well. I mean,
I'm not saying that the team, the fans sometimes get too fixated on a couple of the bottom guys doing a solid job. Like this is Ray Shero said this before in terms of evaluating talent. When the guys with the lower ceilings, you're the kindest to in evaluating them because they don't have much room they don't need to do much to play well. Whereas the guys with the most talent, you are the hardest on them.
If they don't have to do a lot to play well and they play well, then I'm happy with them.
I'm saying that, but it's also a job that other players can do. Like you could very well toss in Redmond and Stewart to do almost a similar job. So I'm saying it's not like they aren't replaceable.
Sure, but
respect what they've done and they're working hard.
Right. And that ultimately, Richie, that when you make the point about Mark Stewart, because he struggled, and I agree, he's one of my, you know, the heart and soul guys, a really good guy and a leader on and off the ice for this team. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if Ellerbe, put it this way, if Ellerbe or Party continues to play as well as they have, then you have a situation where Claude Noel has to say, okay, well, Keaton Ellerbe has been really good for us on the third pair.
Right.
So, you know what, Stewart's going to have to sit out a couple games. And if he struggles, you expect Mark Stewart to be the guy that gets that roster spot over Keaton Ellerbe. But right now, you know, for a guy to come into Winnipeg and you know, just do exactly what he's asked to do, play solid defensively, Don't make too many mistakes. You know, there's a few things once in a while that, about his game that you're, you know, but for the most part, he's just been solid playing 12 minutes a game, and that's all you want. But I know what Richie's saying. They're going to have to make some decisions, because once the D crystallizes Richie and you have Trouba and you have Bogosian mm-hmm. back and everybody's healthy, you know, because they've had, it's been a revolving door this season for defensemen. And, you know, for a while there, you get a little bit nervous, but. You know, they've managed to weather the storm, if you want to look at it like that.
Before this Bogosian one, they've had their core top four they expected this year playing. I mean, one thing to take in consideration, guys, is the fact that Ellerby is an RFA after this year, and he's 25 years old, and Stewart's a UFA after this year. And he makes more money, 1.7 a year, more than double what Ellerby makes. And if Ellerby can do a similar gig and he's younger.
Yeah. Money rules all. Sometimes.
Yep. Yeah, I'll say it plays a factor for sure.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll look at tomorrow's Jets Wild game in St. Paul. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, Hockey Hall of Fame journalist, author of the new book, 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story, Al Strachan is going to join us on the show. This segment is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest-growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada, with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association at cga-manitoba.org. Certified General Accountants, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, tomorrow night, the Jets visit the Minnesota Wild in St. Paul, Minnesota. Puck drop 7 o'clock. Coverage starts on this fine station at 4 p.m., You know, we've seen the Wild, what is it, one time so far this year? Have they visited here yet?
No, they were in Minnesota.
They're in Minnesota, yeah, that was a couple of weeks ago. Jets didn't play very well. Lost a, I think it was a 2-1 final, if I'm not mistaken. My brain doesn't work going that far back.
It was 2-1.
Yeah, well, yep. There you go. Every now and then, monkey hits the right key on the typewriter.
Yep.
What do you expect the Jets to see from the Minnesota Wild tomorrow night?
Well, Richie, they're going to see a team that is absolutely red hot. And that line of Zach Parise, Mikko Koivu, and Jason Pominville might be one of the best lines in all of hockey right now. Those guys are unbelievable at controlling the puck, their speed. They've got shooters on that line, face-off guys. I mean, Koivu specifically is one of the top face-off guys. And, you know, they've got some depth there. And Ryan Suter right now is certainly in the Norris conversation, Richie. Josh Harding is doing an excellent job in goal there for the Wild, pardon me. And, you know, you look at the Wild. A couple of years ago, the Wild were, you know, doing excellent in the Western Conference, and they, you know, sputtered out. But the Jets are going to see an absolutely fast and extremely good team, quite frankly. The Wild are going to be a tough challenge. And the thing with the Wild is they play a very, you know, tight checking game. But, you know, they've improved offensively as well. And you throw in guys like Charlie Coyle, who's started off slowly, granted. But he's a guy that, you know, is starting to find himself as an NHL player. And, you know, you're facing a team that's a big challenge. I mean, you know, you've beat the Wings and the Sharks. And I'd put the Wild up there right now with a lot of teams in the West, not just where they are at in the standings, but they're a very good team. And that defense, for me, was one of the reasons why I didn't pick them to make the playoffs. But mm-hmm. the guys like Jared Spurgeon, Marco Scandella, those guys are maturing as NHL players, and they're doing a pretty admirable job, I got to say.
Well, they're playing Ryan Suter like 48 minutes a game.
He leads the NHL in time on ice per game, 29 minutes and 43 seconds.
It's ridiculous.
Look at his last few games.
I mean, four straight games, he's top 30 minutes.
Yeah, it's wild. No pun intended. Yeah, no. But, I mean, if you look at, you know, as he's even moving Pominville around, and Pominville's playing with Granlund a lot, and Michael Granlund's really gained some confidence, really good skill guy. You know, Niederreiter, you know, starting to come into his own a bit. But you're right, it's anchored by the top line with Mikko Koivu and Parise, and, you know, Coyle's lined up their last game. for the Wild against the Panthers, and Coyle popped a goal in that game, and he was injured for a while. Speed, as you mentioned, they have speed. They are they back check, they go to the net. They have a lot of talent, and I think Elliot Freeman wrote about the Wilds holding on to the puck more this year. Yeah, they have more talent.
They should.
Yeah, exactly. And so Pominville has obviously been hot, great shooter. And look at the mix that they have, right? Parise goes to the net, not a natural goal scorer in terms of like Stamkos and Ovechkin, but he goes to the net and gets his goals. Pominville is a great shooter. Koivu is a brilliant passer. Granlund's a great passer. Then you got the Brodziak Cook guys. They can skate and they can check and they can score a bit for a third line. You have a fourth line with Konopka who can win some draws, and Heatley who can't do anything. He's washed.
Well, they've put Richie, just quickly, they've had Danny Heatley on the first line, the second line, the third line. Right
up.
Now he's playing on the fourth line.
He's done.
Well, because you mentioned the Charlie Coyles, the Nino Niederreiters, the Jason Pominvilles. These guys are just, you know, heads above, better than Heatley right now. And you know, is Heatley a checker right now? Like, has he turned into a grinder?
He's got some chances to score, but I mean, Dan Haley's, you know, his best days are unfortunately behind
him. 50 goal scorer.
Yeah, but he can't move. That's a problem. He can't get to the spots, and he doesn't play with Joe Thornton anymore, or Jason Spezza. But Koivu's good, and you can't play with Koivu, then you got issues.
Yep.
You look at their back end, you know, Suter logs big minutes. Brodin getting quietly so effective. As you mentioned, Jarrett Spurgeon, who's really turned into a nice player.
Yep.
I mean, they have some issues there in terms of long-term depth-wise going into the playoffs, but Harding has been brilliant.
Well, stop to talk about Harding for a second. His numbers are incredible.
They are.
945 save percentage, a goals against average of 1.26.
Keep in mind, Josh Harding, this is the most he's ever played. This is the first time in his career he's been a number one goaltender. Guys, he's been Nicholas Backstrom's backup for about 10 years now. So, I mean, kudos to him. And we're going to talk to Mike Greenlay a little bit more later on in the show. But, I mean, this guy, this is a big story here.
It is. And you're right, Ez. He's been backup for a long, long time. If you're looking at it from the Jets' perspective, you know, the Jets last night were a faster team than Philly. Mm-hmm. But they're not a faster team than Minnesota. Minnesota's one of the fastest teams in the league. So how did the Jets combat Minnesota's speed? Well, that's where Bogosian's injury is so significant. Because if you're throwing Stewart back in, well, he's not going to do it, and maybe he will be healthy enough to play in his home state. Party, Ellerby, you know, Buff, Klitsam, and Enstrom, you're going to have a lot of problems. Some of those guys can skate, don't get me wrong, but you're going to have a lot of problems combating that speed.
Yep.
And because they have so much speed and talent, they come at you, and the Jets aren't great. They've been getting better in their defensive coverage, definitely getting better, but aren't great. So this presents as a difficult matchup. In terms of the Jets facing the Wild. Now, look at the other way around. The Wild back end, Suter is going to play against your lad little Wheeler line, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, those second and third pairings that the Wild have, if the Jets' second line could ever get going, certainly the opportunity is there to take advantage of some of those guys, especially guys like Spurgeon who are talented but aren't that big. Or, you know, guys like Clayton Stoner, or guys who aren't as good skaters as Spurgeon. So there's opportunities to take advantage of this team. But they need guys like Kane to get off the schneid already. Enough's enough.
Sure.
Kane been?
Well, he's been... You know,
he played last night?
He played. He didn't play tremendously well. He was relatively invisible. And we'll talk more about Evander Kane a little bit later on in the show.
Well, they were, you know, just as a side. And I mean, this isn't an excuse. But the Flyers were punishing him early on in that game. I mean, you know, whether it was Coburn or Downey or Ronaldo. I mean, they were going after him. And I'm not sure if... Maybe, you know, he took such a beating in that first period. But, yeah. I mean, Kane guys, you know, how many times can we say it? Skill set of Evander Kane is unbelievable. And, you know, I am of the belief that he could be a 40-goal scorer in the NHL. And he hasn't been putting the puck in the net. And he's one of the guys, along with Andrew Ladd, Brian Little, and Blake Wheeler, that they depend on. I mean, the Jets don't have 10 guys that they can depend on for goals. Sure, if, you know, guys like... Setoguchi are going, and Scheifele and Frolik, sure, but I mean, Kane's a primary scorer. Setoguchi and Scheifele, those are your secondary scorers, and you know he's been a little bit off, and maybe there's some lingering effects to the injury, but you know he's not playing his best hockey. And early on this season, he was the best scorer, the best player, and you know Brian Little and Ladd have kind of taken over that, but you know Kane, he definitely has to get it going, and he knows that.
And Luke Shen was going at him last night. Those guys were battling in the first year with Toronto and Winnipeg, so they have some hatred for each other.
Sure. Let's go to break. When we come back, Hockey Hall of Fame journalist, author of a new book about Wayne Gretzky, Al Strachan, is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, wearing a proper fitting custom-made mouthguard designed for you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center is an essential part of your protective equipment. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Earlier this morning, prior to us getting on air, we had the opportunity to sit down with Al Strachan. He's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist. His new book, which is out in stores as of Tuesday, this past Tuesday, is called 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story. It's an authorized biography of Wayne Gretzky. This is going to be over for the next 30 minutes or so. Here is our interview that we conducted earlier today with Al Strachan. Al, thanks very much for joining us. Good afternoon and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Well, it's nice to be back. I've been here before, but didn't have a book, I think, the other times.
You had different books. This is a brand new book.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, good.
Al, well, the first question we want to spend the interview talking about Gretzky and his career and his impact on hockey, of course. We see all the hype in current times surrounding Connor McDavid and the litany of next ones, the guys who are going to be the next Gretzkys. If Gretzky was entering the NHL in today's media climate, how immense would the hype be surrounding him?
Well, given the social media today and as you say, the hype, I think it would be huge. And in fact, Scott Bowman told me that he has seen a kid in Chicago at 9 years old who's already getting hyped and looks very much like Gretzky. He says, 9 years old, he's playing with 12-year olds and they can't get the puck off him. So I'm sure we'll be hearing about this kid in the near future. And there was a lot, though, in Gretzky's day. I mean, people forget that one of the guys who was hyped as being the next Guy Lafleur or the next Rocket Richard or whatever was Mark Crawford, the guy who wouldn't use Gretzky in the shootout.
It's funny how those things come back around.
Mm-hmm.
Al, obviously Gretzky played on those great teams in the 80s. From your perspective, having covered the Habs of the 70s, how do you think the Oilers teams, of those Gretzky teams in the 80s, fit into the overall best teams of all time?
I want to ask Scott Bowman to give me the best team he's ever coached, like over 50 years or something, best goalie, best defenseman, and best forwards. He said, you can't do that. He said, it is unfair to everybody concerned to try and do that. Hockey changes so much. There are different eras, different styles, different teammates, different coaches, and he said, you simply can't do that. I think it's enough to say that they were both dominant in their era. I think Montreal could have won 5 cups in a row in the 70s had they not had 8 starters injured in the 5th year after winning 4 in a row. And I think Edmonton, as we all know, could easily have won 5 in a row, except for just perhaps a little bit of overconfidence in one of those games there. And, even after and a bad break, Steve Smith, a very good guy and a really nice person, he's hate to see it happen, to bank that puck in off Grant Fuhr's leg, and that cost them in that year. But even then, they still had most of the period to tie it up and miss some chances. It just that they got a little bit cocky and then came back. But I think both of those teams could have won 5 cups in a row, and I think when you've won 5 cups in a row, then you're dominant teams. But the Montreal team played in an era when really, if we were playing against the Soviets in an extended period, wouldn't have done well at all, because the guys weren't in as good a shape as the Europeans. They didn't do dry land training. They didn't have the intricate passing and all that sort of stuff. They were certainly dominant in the NHL, and given time would probably have been dominant over any Russian team, certainly a club team. Whereas by 84, led by Glenn Sather and Gretzky and other Oilers, Coffey, Anderson, people like that, mm-hmm. in that Canada Cup, we were saying we were going to match the Soviets stride for stride skating, and that had never happened before with Canadian hockey. So the whole game had changed so much by the time the Oilers ran off their string of cups in the 80s, it wouldn't really be fair to compare the two. They were both great in their day.
Al, when you think of those 1980s Edmonton Oilers teams, you mentioned Paul Coffey and Glenn Anderson and Jari Kurri, and there were obviously a lot of really good players on those teams, but you think about those teams and the two guys, the relationships that probably you think of the most as being the most special, and the two guys that really got the most points, obviously, for those teams are Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier. Can you talk about the differences in leadership between Mark Messier and Wayne Gretzky?
I sure can, but I'm not. Is that right? Do you think Messier had more points than Jari Kurri?
No, that's true. When I said right after I said that, yeah. I realized Kurri had
anyway,
a few points.
I know what the question is, and it's certainly a valid one. They were really very, very different people, and there were some reservations about Gretzky being a captain because he wasn't the forceful type of person that Mess was, and Mess was really dynamic and went to people, including people on his own team, and physically impressed upon them the fact that they had better smarten up. And in one of my earlier books, I told the story about him getting Kent Nielsen by the throat and putting him up against the wall and saying, listen, you little Swedish so-and-so, you don't smarten up. You've been floating all your life. You float with us, you'll go back to Sweden in a box. And so Nielsen played the best 6 weeks of his life because they got him at the trade deadline and then retired. I think he was more scared of Messier than the rest of the league, you know. But that was the kind of, Gretz would never do anything like that. Gretz, he did have a temper at times and would shut, but he was never that kind of forceful leader that would demand things of others. He demanded of himself an awful lot, very, very proud and very upset if he didn't play well or made a mistake, but he wouldn't go after other people the way Mess was. And also, another one of the differences is that Gretz would open up, and you can see a lot of that in this book. People that I've talked to since it came out last Tuesday, the recurring theme is, geez, I never knew all these things about him. I didn't know about his personality. I knew his records and stuff, and I knew some of the things he'd done, but I didn't really realize what he was like as a person. And he opened up to me an awful lot. You know, not that I'm a psychiatrist or anything, but we would just talk about things, and he was always just very, very honest about himself. Mess was never like that, and I remember one time when some sports editor, as sports editors are wont to do, demanded a story on Messier and getting him to open up about himself, you know, and it was very hard. And I just put it bluntly to Mess. I said, look, I know you hate talking about yourself, and I know it's hard for you, but on this occasion, because we know each other so well, could you really give it a try and just tell me something about yourself and your own feelings and not the team, you know, that sort of thing. So they were very different in that way, but they were both very strong leaders in a totally different way.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Al Strachan. He's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist and author of 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story, which was just released this past Tuesday.
Now, when you hear one, I thought an interesting comment was made by Paul Coffey's dad when talking about Glenn Sather, in that Coffey may have not succeeded in the NHL as he did if not for the style and the confidence that Glenn Sather kind of instilled in him. Can you talk about Glenn Sather and his effect on that 80s team?
He had a tremendous effect. He'd been around a lot, and so I first got to know Glenn when he was a member of the Montreal Canadiens in the 70s when I covered them. And he's one of those outgoing people, and he just knows how to jab people one way or another to get them going. When he was in Montreal, his favorite target was Kenny Dryden, because Kenny was just such a pompous, aloof person, and Slats would go after him all the time and, you know, try and bring him down to everybody else's level. And he takes pride, really, I think, in just sort of getting people aroused a little bit one way or another. And he was intelligent enough to realize that the same thing doesn't work for everybody. And that, to me, is the essence of a very good coach. You realize which guys need to be praised and which guys need to be prodded. Some guys, if you prod them, will sulk. And whereas some guys, if you prod them, will now play their hardest to prove you're wrong. And similarly, some guys, if you praise them, will think, boy, this is great, I've got to do even better, whereas others will say, oh, well, he's happy with me, I don't need to work as hard now. And so you need to know exactly what to do. And in Slats's case, he would criticize everybody, but he made sure that most of the criticism, when it was in the room, would go to the star players. Gretzky and Coffey, especially, were his two favorite targets in the room. And yet he would go after the others, but he didn't want the others to think that, he's just going after me. He wouldn't go after those guys. Well, he did go after those guys, and I think probably his third favorite target was Coffey. And Coffey's a very sensitive guy, and he really got hurt by some of it, I think more perhaps than he should have, even though Glenn would at times praise him. I remember I was asked to do a story, again, another sports editor, not my idea, the thing being before the Oilers had won the Cup, saying, can they ever win a Cup with Paul Coffey on defense? And Sather's answer and the end of the story ended up with Sather saying, we'll never win one without him. And, you know, so he would do that to him, but at times he would be highly critical of Paul after a game. And I know Jack pretty well, Paul's dad. He was on that Swedish tour with us, and he's a good guy. And he was a little bit sensitive, too, which may have been where Paul got it from. He was very, very defensive when Sather criticized Paul. But I think nowadays when you talk to Paul, Paul will say, you know, this, he made me what I am because these guys come in, especially guys like Coffey and Gretzky and people like that, they come into the league with tremendous talent. You've got to have tremendous talent to even get to the NHL. But they had even more when they got there. But talent isn't enough. You have to keep pushing. You have to keep improving. And I don't think Coffey would have pushed and improved if it hadn't been for Slats continually jabbing him from behind with something or other. So, and he did so much for all those guys, and he would be highly critical of them behind closed doors, but boy, if you ever cut one of them up in the paper, he'd come after you. And you can see that to this day. The Edmonton media is one of the most team-friendly, yeah. You know, so it, oh boy, you know, we better not be critical of the Oilers and that, you know. And so if you went in there and did it, as I can attest, Slats would come over and you'd have a shouting match and sometimes bring the player over and say, well, now say to him what you said in the paper, you know, stuff like this, you know. So he I think he did a tremendous job as a coach, and I think later on when he went to the Rangers and didn't do the world's greatest job and hasn't won a cup and that sort of thing, that it really hurt his reputation, and people don't understand what a great hockey guy he really is.
You know, when we talk about Gretzky, obviously, you know, the four cups and the Edmonton days are incredible. The 87 Canada Cup, though, stands up for most in terms of Gretzky and Lemieux playing together, being maybe as dominant as any combo. Where does that hockey, that tournament, and the performance of those two guys stand out to you in, you know, hockey history?
Oh, it was tremendous. It was probably the best hockey I've ever seen over an extended period. And you have three games that go into, well, I guess the last one ended just before overtime, but 6-5, and great, great skaters up and down and tremendous talent being shown. And in the final game, Canada coming back from a 3-goal deficit, and the stars on display, as it were, from the goalie on out, and Gretzky being the shining light of hockey at the time and making that very clear by his performance, and the emergence of Mario. This was when Mario stepped onto the stage, really. He had been in the NHL, and he'd obviously been a star player, and he'd been a big scorer, but he'd never really dedicated himself to hockey. He was one of those guys who came in and, as I say, had an awful lot of talent and wasn't really willing to push it. And this was one of the times when Gretzky did get mad and did show some leadership and told Mario outright. And this, of course, is typical of Gretzky in that he would never tell me this story, never did tell me this, but Keenan did. And this book stuff in this, I talked to Keenan a fair bit for this book because his some of the things Gretzky's biggest moments were done with Keenan as a coach, you know. And Keenan says, I saw this. I saw it happen right in front of me. He said, he told him, he said, you know, you are wasting your time. You're wasting your talent because the series, the camp was in Montreal, and so Lemieux is now back home more or less. He's out messing around at nights and having a good time, and because the practices were usually in the afternoon, which Keenan said he set up for those of us in the media because we were all too lazy and hungover to show up in the morning. And, but, you know, well, he's probably right, but he doesn't mention the fact that he was drinking with us every night and leading the songs and everything, so he was one of the reasons we were in that shape. But anyway, they would have these afternoon practices, so Mario didn't have to get up in the morning or anything. And Gretzky finally blew up at him and said, it's about time you started to take this seriously and take your career seriously and take your responsibilities to Canada seriously. And when you're on the ice, when you're part of something like this, you give it everything you've got. And Keenan was stunned. He says, I saw it happen. And then after that, that rapport having been established, now Gretzky was able to go to Lemieux as a friend and say, look, okay, here's how we've got to do this. Like, I pass, you shoot. Are we clear on this concept? And you're a better shooter than I am, he told Mario. I can pass. I can set you up. And without saying, although it was true, that he was the best passer in the world. He had all different kinds of passes he could make, you know, that he would set it up with no problem, but he wanted Mario to do the shooting. And if you look at that famous goal, the one that won the third game of that 87 Canada Cup, he passes it to Mario, and just to make sure it's not coming back, he lifts his stick up towards his chest. So had Mario looked over to see if there was a target to pass to, there wasn't. Uh-huh. You know, you're going to shoot this one. And of course, Larry Murphy was never getting the puck. Gretz says in the book there, you know, Larry Murphy had no more chance to get in that pass than my father. His father was in the stands.
Al, the trade of Gretzky, this goes without saying, but when Wayne Gretzky gets traded from the Edmonton Oilers to the LA Kings, that trade left such an indelible mark on the NHL and on Canada. And it was like we had lost, you know, our greatest, you know, player. And as far as that trade goes, at the time, what was your perception of that trade? And now looking back on it 25 years later, how has your perception of that trade changed?
Indelible is an excellent word for that, because indelible means it can't be erased, and you still see the impact of that trade today. That trade was the one that resulted in teams in Dallas and Atlanta while they were there, and Phoenix while they are there, and Colorado, all that southern expansion, Anaheim. None of that would have happened without Gretzky going to L.A. In fact, it's not clear that the L.A. Kings would have survived, because they'd already gone bankrupt a couple of times, and there was danger at that time of them moving out until Bruce McNall came in and took over from Jerry Buss. And actually, Buss was a basketball guy. He just happened to have the Kings, and then Bruce made the Kings into an entity by bringing Gretzky in, which made hockey acceptable in the United States. So certainly it was, as you say, indelible, and it remains to this day to a great degree. As for the loss to Canada, I was sad. One of the reasons that I got to know Wayne so well was that I had written a column way, way back at the beginning. People tend to forget, or perhaps never knew, mainly because they weren't born then, that when Gretz started in the league, a lot of people were highly critical of him. They said he was a flash in the pan. He could have never played in the 16 league, that somebody like this would just burn out. He might have one, but everybody would learn how to play against him, and that would be the end of it. And I wrote a column saying, you know, are you mad? Why is it the Canadians just seem to feel the need to denigrate every Canadian who does well? So we should accept this kid for what he is. He's a tremendous player. He's the kind of thing that we have never seen in our memory. Instead of being critical of him, we should do what Brazil did with Pele and turn him into a national treasure so he can never be traded and never leave the country. And that was one of the reasons that we started hanging out together a bit. He saw that column. Walter saw it and passed it along to him. And, you know, we started talking about that and talking about other things, and we became good friends over the years. But so I was sad when he left Edmonton, certainly. I didn't really want him to go to the States, but now I realize that because I am a hockey fan, I don't have a single team I root for. I just like to see the game do well. I like to see the Canadian teams do well, obviously, but I like to see the whole league do well, and I realize that it's because of that move that it is where it is today. And much as I don't agree with a lot of the things that Gary Bettman does, he is working very hard to make it a stable, continent-wide league that has acceptance among the North American population. And I think all of that, really, the base for all of that goes back to that Gretzky trade.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Hockey Hall of Fame journalist Al Strachan. His new book is called 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story. Al, speaking of illegal curves, if Marty McSorley isn't called for one in 1993, do the Kings win the Cup?
Gretzky says, I mean, we talked about that at some length for this thing, and he says that Montreal was a better team. He said, we didn't lose because of Marty's stick. And he's a gentleman, as always, and a diplomat, but I know he was heartbroken by that. I know he was very, very upset by it, very upset by it. And it's really a bit of a shame that Marty gets the blame. The Canadians had gone in to the King's dressing room and had measured sticks in the afternoon, and there is stuff in this book about Gretz talking about that, how he knew that they had been in there, and he doesn't say how he knew, but I'll tell you how he knew. He knew because Sather used to do it all the time in Edmonton, but anyway, he knew they had been in there, and he warned the guys to watch out for sticks, but the problem was that McSorley, Zhitnik, and Robitaille had no legal sticks. All three of them.
Really?
So it just happened to be which one was on the ice, and it's to McSorley's credit that in the dying moments of the game, he was the one on the ice and the one that Demers targeted and went after for the stick. But Wayne says, you know, people could say, well, okay, if Marty hadn't done that, we wouldn't. He said, but if we hadn't had Marty against Toronto, we wouldn't have been in that position. We would never have got to the final without the way Marty handled Doug Gilmore in Toronto. So he doesn't blame him.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 25 minutes after 1 o'clock, you just finished listening to part one of our interview from earlier today with Al Strachan, Hockey Hall of Fame journalist and author of the new book, 99 Gretzky, His Game, His Story. Part two of the interview will deal with the Nagano Olympics, Wayne Gretzky's time with the New York Rangers, and why he didn't end up as a Toronto Maple Leaf. Here is part two of our interview with Al Strachan.
You know, Al, when you talk about Gretzky, obviously the short period he's in St. Louis gets a little bit glossed over, but you know, having watched those playoffs, and obviously, you know, you having watched those closely, if Nick Kiprios doesn't take out Grand Fuhr, and I heard Kiprios talking about it this week even, if he doesn't take out Grand Fuhr, what do you think that team does? Do you think that team can beat Detroit and beat Colorado even?
Oh, yeah. I think they win the Cup if Kiprios doesn't do that, and they thought that too. There's a whole spectrum change in the way that Grant Fuhr tends goal and John Casey tends goal. And again, this is one of the things that Keenan talks about. You know, he said, John Casey, God bless him, did a tremendous job for us, but he's not Grant Fuhr. And you take the Detroit Red Wings to double overtime, and then there's a seeing eye goal that Casey didn't see with Yzerman, of all people, shooting from the point, just trying to basically blast it towards the net somewhere and praying, and the prayer came to pass, you know, and they won that game 1-0 in the fifth period, and I covered every game of that, and St. Louis, they had some bad moments. I think maybe the first game was it they got blown out. The couple, you know, there were times when they didn't look good, but overall, they deserved to win, and with Grant Fuhr in the net, I'm sure they would have won, and Kiprios did it on purpose, according to Keenan, and I think Kipper, in his more lucid moments, will admit he did it on purpose. Yeah. And it was a shame, really, because it did stop Gretzky. To my mind, I believe it stopped him from getting another Stanley Cup ring.
Al, some people forget that before Gretzky ended up with the New York Rangers, the Toronto Maple Leafs tried to sign him. How close?
Well, some of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Cliff did.
That's right. How close were the Leafs to signing Gretzky?
Oh, it was done. All Stavro had to do was rubber stamp it, and Stavro wouldn't do it. Gretzky wanted to end his career in Toronto. When he was playing in that backyard in Brantford on the frozen pond and all that sort of stuff, in his mind it was Maple Leaf Gardens, and he was scoring for the Leafs in those days. And he is a great student of hockey heritage and hockey history, and he always knew everything that was going on. We would go at the beginning of those Canada Cup series and talk to him, and he'd tell us what was happening in Russian hockey, what was happening in Czech hockey and Swedish hockey and Finnish hockey, and why we had to worry about certain aspects of each team in Canada and all this sort of stuff. I mean, the guy knew the game inside out. He wasn't just one of those guys who goes out there and plays and knows nothing about the rest of the game. And he's always loved the heritage and the history of the game. And to his mind, finishing his career in Maple Leaf Gardens would have been just wonderful to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And he offered them a deal, $3 million a year to play, and Cliff was happy with it, took the deal to Steve Stavro, and Stavro said, how many seats is that going to sell? And Stavro, of course, was a grocer, not a hockey guy, and just trying to make money in way over his head, and facing a battle, actually, from a lot of people who said he had effectively stolen the Leafs from the charities that Harold Ballard intended them to be given to upon his death, and cash-strapped and just wouldn't make the deal. So Gretzky, instead of taking the Leafs offer of $3 million, went to the Rangers for $6 million.
Yeah, and he goes to New York there, Alan, and reunites obviously with Mark Messier, and that team, the only year that they're together in New York, you know, beats the Panthers first round, beats the Devils in second round, beats them both in five, has a lot of injuries. You know, Brian Leetch busts his wrists in, I think, game two of the conference finals. Alexei Kovalev's out flatly. If that team's healthy, you think they give the Flyers a little bit of a run, and certainly the Flyers didn't give the Red Wings much of a run in that final.
Yeah, they probably would have handled the Flyers. I don't know, the Red Wings were good that year, so I don't know that they would have won. And I know that in the long run, Gretzky just felt that he didn't get enough support around him at that stage. You know, Pavel Bure was on the loose, if you remember,
mm-hmm.
And Neil Smith wouldn't make the trade because he wanted to hang on to Manny Malhotra and stuff like that. And It didn't work out, I don't think, the way he wanted it to on the ice, but he really did enjoy his years in New York, and he had good time there. The people were good to him. He was well accepted by his teammates and by the people of New York, who can be very critical, as you may know. And so he had a good time. But after the 3 years, injuries were starting to pile up on him, too. He had a bad back, and he was missed an extended period with the back, and at times thought that he would never play again. And there's quite a bit in there about him talking and saying, you know, he might never even skate again. And he was really quite worried that there were times when he was down, and probably from a physical point of view, as opposed to, you know, a serious loss or something, probably his darkest time in hockey, actually, while he was there. But there were also some good moments, and I don't think that team was ever good enough, though, to win a cup.
You know, Al, when he goes to New York and goes to reunite with Messier, how angry was he that Neil Smith didn't ante up the money to pay Messier the following summer?
Well, he wasn't thrilled about it. But, you know, there are other sections in there where we talk about his relationship to people who run teams. I mean, I knew him as well as anybody. We would talk, and, you know, we would talk in bars and stuff like that, over beers, and, you know, we'd be totally honest with each other, because he knew that I would never print anything that seemed sort of confrontational or a problem without checking with him the next morning and that sort of stuff. But even under those circumstances, I never once heard him criticize his coach, even Robbie Fatorik. He wouldn't do it. And he felt the players play, coaches coach, managers manage, and he would do his job as well as he possibly could. He expected everybody else to do their job as well as they possibly could, and didn't feel that he would help anything by undermining those people. So he may have been having some concerns about it when he was at home and thinking about it, but he wouldn't express those concerns to anyone, really. He would just, you know, he'd be worried and be kind of hoping that these things would happen, but he wouldn't be going out and getting mad about it. He'd just hope that it would change. I know he wanted Neil to get Bure. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But it's just because he wanted people around him. It wasn't specifically Bure, necessarily. He wanted better players around him that could support him, and Bure was the one who was high profile and available at the time.
Al, in the book you talk about Nagano, and we all remember the vision of Wayne Gretzky sitting on the bench, not being chosen by Mark Crawford in the shootout, and Canada loses to the Czech Republic in that shootout. In your opinion, was that Canadian team mismanaged? Was it miscoached? Was it both? What was your take on what happened in Nagano?
Oh, it was absolutely both. There's no doubt about it. And when I was talking earlier, and I was struggling for words a little bit there about explaining Gretzky's darkest moment, and I struggle a little bit and mention physically, his darkest moment in hockey as a hockey player was that, sitting there on that bench, and he hasn't been chosen. And when I was talking earlier as well about his love of the heritage of the game, he had always wanted to play in the NHL. He'd always wanted to win a Stanley Cup, and he'd always wanted to win an Olympic gold medal. And this was to be his last chance, and there it was, and he didn't get a chance to show what he could do at that stage. He was still their best player on the ice, mm-hmm. you know, when during the games, and he'd had a great series. It wasn't as if, well, this is an old guy who can't play anymore, not so. But what had happened there was that the business side of hockey, to a degree, had been responsible. Down in Florida, or not in Florida, rather, in Philadelphia, Ed Snyder, wanting to make money, as he always does, had put up a new building. Spectrum was to be replaced, and they needed a star to sell the high-priced tickets that they were going to have in this much larger building. They went after Eric Lindros. They gave him a contract that at the time was far beyond anything that hockey had ever seen for somebody of that age, because they had to have a developing star to sell the tickets. The original Lindros deal with Philadelphia was not a hockey deal at all. It was an economic deal. It was a financial deal to make money for Ed Snyder and to make a success of his new building. So now that they're in that position, Bobby Clark is running the Olympic team, and he has to perpetuate this myth that Lindros is the greatest player in the game. So they make Lindros the captain. They name him. He's one of the first ones named to the team. It was only at the last minute they decided they would even put Gretzky on the team, because they knew that Gretzky there, now there's some doubt about it. And they thought, well, maybe we might need a fourth center, or maybe we might take Wayne Gretzky, but, you know, do we really need that many centers? Well, we've got Eric Lindros, after all, and so on and so forth. And then there was the mob scene that I described, mm-hmm. that you saw in the Globe and Mail thing there. Everybody wants Gretzky. They don't want Lindros, the people around the world. And so they were doing everything they could to downplay Gretzky's importance and make Lindros the rising star to sell tickets for Ed Snyder. And of course Lindros got to shoot in the shootout and and Gretzky didn't, and he, to his credit, wouldn't have been worried about all those aspects of it, but he certainly was worried about the fact that this was his chance to win an Olympic gold medal, and it didn't come to fruition, and he didn't even get a chance to make it come to fruition.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Al Strachan. He's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist and author of the new book, 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story.
Al, how much redemption did Wayne feel after the 2002 the Salt Lake City Olympics?
He didn't talk about it. He's not that kind of person. Yeah. He wouldn't say, honestly, I told you. He was just so happy to win it, because now he had his hockey gold medal, even if it wasn't as a player. It wasn't quite the same. I think he wanted one, but he's very, very proud, obviously. He's a very proud Canadian, and he was just delighted to get that win, and no matter who it was against, it didn't have to be against the Americans, although the team was sort of geared to beat them, and it was just a total delight for him, really, and he wouldn't see it as being redemption or anything. He'd just rejoice in the pure pleasure of having won it.
Al, Wayne Gretzky's time as owner of the Phoenix Coyotes, part owner I should say, coach of the Phoenix Coyotes, how do you explain that experiment?
And explain in what sense? Why he did it?
Well, just how would you sum up maybe more so that whole experience for him, and as far as his how he liked being a coach, and more so as a coach.
Okay, yeah, he loves being a coach. He loves being with the players, and he loves being down on the ice, even if he's only coaching, and he loves helping kids. And, you know, if you get a guy like Kyle Turris, who was just coming in at that stage for Phoenix, and a guy with talent, really, but doesn't always know how to use it, who better is, say, here, now this is a difficult play here, but if you can make this turn right here in the corner, come on, put the puck between your legs, flip it up here, you can score a goal. Like, who would be better to explain that to you than Wayne Gretzky? I mean, you know, who do you want doing that, Ricky Lee or Wayne Gretzky? No. I mean, so he had certain attributes that he could offer, and there are those who say he wasn't that great on the X and O's, which I disagree with, but he did have a full staff there with him. He had Barry Smith, who'd been in Detroit, who's as good as anybody on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he did enjoy very much being back with the players, being down on the ice, back in the routine, traveling around with the team and all that sort of stuff, and seeing all the people he knows in all the different cities. And yeah, he really did enjoy it. But as is so often the case, when you run into a problem, the lawyers are behind it, and the team ran into financial troubles, then there was the bankruptcy, and then the whole thing is shut down, and he can't go anywhere else because he can't go and play for another team when you're owning part of one, even though that partnership or the ownership is more abundant, that the team is bankrupt and not operating. So it put him out of hockey for a long time, and I fervently hope he gets back into it soon.
Well, that leads us perfectly into our final question here, Al. Along those same lines, when and where do you see Wayne Gretzky back in the NHL?
He gets offers pretty well from every team that has an opening. I wouldn't be surprised if he got a call from Buffalo not that long ago. And you know, wherever they get an opening, Wayne gets a call and politely turns them down until he's ready to accept one. And so it would just be a pure guess. I mean, we could easily speculate that the perfect place for him right now would be Edmonton, obviously. But I don't think that he would go in there. Because to do so would mean the firing of a couple of his very closest friends, and Kevin Lowe and Craig McTavish, and not to mention some others in the organization, guys who aren't as obvious. And I don't think he would do that or go back to Canada even, probably, because all his kids are American now and his wife is American, and much as he does everything he can for Team Canada and the Canadian Olympic effort, and really was influential in Vancouver even getting the Olympics, I don't know that he would want to move back to Canada unless it was Toronto. And I think that's a possibility. I think he'd still like to come back to the Leafs, but that's a strange operation there. You know, there's a lot, if you want to talk about what goes on in Leafland, that's another one-hour interview. So it would just be a guess, really, where he would go. And personally, I'd like to see him as commissioner, but I think that's a bit of a pipe dream on my part.
I think most hockey fans the world over would appreciate seeing Wayne Gretzky as commissioner of the NHL. Al Strachan, he's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist. His new book is called 99, Gretzky, His Game, His Story. Al, we can't thank you enough for giving your time to us this morning.
Okay, well, thank you, and thanks for all the plugs.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Al.
Okay.
Take care.
You've been listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch The Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.